Our third commenter on the paper is Professor Mel Bradford, professor of English at the University of Dallas. He's an author and editor of several books on the literature of the South, some 200 essays on American life and politics, co-editor with Richard Weaver's The Southern Tradition at Bay, and an editor of Modern Age. Politically, he's the former vice chairman of the Democratic Party of Texas and director of North Texas Wallace Campaign in 1972. Stan Evans says he's solid enough to have been from Indiana. Well,
I'm a little intimidated by all these bureaucrats, present and former. I've entitled these brief remarks, Marching Toward the Cannon's Roar. Or Just Before the Battle, Mother. I'm very much persuaded of our speaker's analysis of the present state and nature of the United States Congress. I learned years ago to expect nothing less than authority from any performance by James McClellan. And assuredly, such telling exposition is a precondition for movement from the forensic to the deliberative mode, from praise or blame to choices in conduct for days ahead. Yet we must not forget that it is nothing more than preconditional, must avoid the endemic misdirection of so much conservative thought that draws it toward the analysis of error and away from the battle still to come. What the right requires most of all is not good social or political or economic theory or even accurate records of times gone by. What it needs is rhetoric, and in this case, a rhetoric for the restoration of the Congress to its former virtue, its representative integrity. What I here contend reflects an old preoccupation in my political thought and experience, an old song. My hope is that it will become a preoccupation with you, a familiar tune. Dr. McClellan speaks to us from inside the congressional ambit and is thus a proper source for diagnosis of corruptions infecting that context. We do get rumors of these corruptions out in the hinterlands, but what we need is such a detailed and composite portrait. But we cannot look there where a peculiar myopia of necessity prevails for an antidote to these poisons. The self-corrective impulse in American politics, and this holds true in congressional as well as in presidential politics, as I have told Jim before, works the other way around, from the bottom up. It is by implication out there in every petty elective rebellion against the influence of Washington City, and in the cold eye with which the electors now regard all politicians who tell them that they agree concerning that excessive power. Isn't it terrible, they say, philosophically, but can do nothing but agree and offer sympathy because disrespect for a prostituted legal system is disorderly and bad for the business atmosphere because the liberals are in control and may at least be said to mean well. In the face of such rightful anger and cynicism, my first recommendation, and this is for people who are interested in getting into Congress and reconstituting it, is visible intransigence, a willingness to offer a level of opposition and with a style inappropriate to the decorums of political civility when the regime is functioning properly and remains in character. I have offered before the example of Parnell and the Irish members, the 19th century British Parliament. They knew very well how to disrupt the most efficient political machinery. Insofar as King Caucus resembles the mountain in the French Republican Convention of 1793. To that extent, all its leading members must be treated in public by their colleagues as desperate men, as aberrations from the accepted political norm, servants of an armed doctrine, who have no vested interest in the health of society, but a great advantage in its disruptions. I recommend to you, for an analog, the discussion in Sallust of the Catiline conspiracy. I lost my place. An air of absolute enmity will, with a great many people who are not quite sure why they're upset, secure assent. Heat up the fires. Give language to the inchoate sense of alarm that already exists in the country, but preach no 11th commandment. A pallid, polite reaction will not do the job. If necessary, promise to jam the machinery of government. run for Congress in order to stop Congress. Combined to arrest the business of both houses, cry treason, and hosts will arise to join in that cry. My second recommendation, now apparently a commonplace at this year's meeting, I'm surprised, is to avoid excessive identification with party. I've been all over the ballpark with regard to party in the last 10 years. It has not, among my friends and neighbors, created distrust. In fact, it works the other way around. Party is now, with most ordinary Americans, another name for organized political opportunism, a name for the forces which see to it that American business is being strangled in regulation, that taxes are prohibitively high, that busing cannot be halted, or our national self-respect preserved abroad. Party men see no priority in the wishes of their constituents, that is, so far as their constituents can perceive. Once in Washington, they seem to serve a new master, and with the party's help, they can hope to justify their deviations from populist rectitude with the claim of additions of influence, the president's ear, a good press, etc. We're familiar with the language. From my own soundings through the years of scandalous activity in partisan politics in Texas, I can tell you one thing. Party loyalty, in the sense I have just described, is fast becoming the mark of Cain. Would-be members of Congress may be prepared to exhibit a little affection for their state party organization. There's a very healthy principle in here, and one that I need not explain to Dr. Kirk, or to most of you, that state organization is fine, and they are, of course, expected to be fiercely loyal to their own local organization. These are their friends. But once elected, a preference for the cooperation of, say, U. Scott over that of James Allen will not wash with the folks back home, no matter what their political identity, their party preference. Do not be mistaken about this. The distrust of our party system, as presently constituted, will be a permanent feature of our political life in the decades just ahead. Mr. Olaska's moral decline is implicit here. Candidates who acknowledge this reality once they are in Washington and who are perceived by those who elected them to acknowledge that reality will hold their support, as will candidates who speak of bureaucracy as if it were a plague, the assembled hosts of Pandemonium and Book Two of Milton's Paradise Lost. My final recommendation is more complicated than its predecessors, but it still involves rhetoric, and it's one that it's somewhat informed with me. The argument from character, or ad hominem, as it affects the practice of campaigners in this post-Watergate era, as it will not do to announce a personal philosophy which we cannot presume to implement, a sentiment crushed by the vast impersonal machinery of government, so it will not serve to preach ideological consistency as a higher priority than the popular will. It will not own the stump do. And particularly in these, let's see, Americans have always distrusted programs, has always distrusted what Michael Oakeshott calls a nomocratic politics. And particularly in these times, they will not follow a man simply because they agree with his views. They ask first what manner of man he is, and this may be an even more developing trend in the decade ahead. To be trusted and loved, and I find this trend to be, in some respects, as repulsive as you must, to be the plain, basically apolitical fellow who, though not certain of his way, and sometimes it's apparently reassuring to the electorate when we appear to be uncertain, can be trusted in a personal sense to be what the older rhetoricians spoke of as the we're bonus, is required if we are to counter the effects of ideology. And perhaps in this connection, to be an openly religious person in the once accepted sense of that term. Package all of this together. I say this contra Mr. Whalen last night about the extent to which we are trapped by circumstances. I think rhetoric is the way out of that trap of the inevitability of committing ourselves to power and surrendering our commitment to liberty. Package this together, and you can market whatever program you prefer. Some of this reality will require us to hold our noses, but the alternatives are not to be considered. Thank you very much.